It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Welcome to it. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. Women working in the Washington State Capitol have been coming forward to talk about the sexual harassment they've faced working in the legislature. Now we're hearing about sexual harassment allegations raised against Republican State Representative Matt Manweller. Those allegations were made nearly 10 years ago by some of his former students. Manweller is a professor at Central Washington University in Ellensburg, and my guest is the Seattle Times investigative reporter who broke the story. Mike Baker, nice to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Representative Manweller was investigated twice at Central Washington University. What were the allegations?
So yeah, in the first investigation, there was sort of an allegation from a student that they had a meeting in his office and that he had sort of made a proposition, touched her leg, and kissed her, and sort of was making a pretty sort of explicit pass at her. And so she had years. This was something that happened, you know, years before, but they investigated it in 2012. That was the focus of their complaint. Then there was also sort of a discussion at that time. They were exploring with different staff members who had heard various rumors and allegations and concerns about him that they were exploring, but didn't go very far because they didn't have a lot of records or documentation or interviews to sort of support that side of things. Then soon after that one came out, there was a second investigation that happened that focused on the case of another woman who said she felt pressured to, you know, go out to a bar with her professor, Matt Manweller, and that he made a pass at her and her friend at that point. And then there was also a sort of second investigation aspect of that investigation looking at someone who had apparently complained during an exit interview. There's sort of a dispute on that one because the woman later said she wasn't complaining about Manweller, that he didn't do anything wrong, that she was complaining about someone else. But the staff members there were pretty insistent in their investigation that she was talking about him.
So how much merit did Central Washington University find in the allegations?
So it was an outside investigator that came in both instances in 2012 and 2013. The conclusion of that report was that there was evidence to suggest that he had violated sexual harassment policies.
Evidence to suggest he violated sexual harassment policies. But here is Manweller defending himself to a Cairo radio host yesterday, saying the university looked into it.
The university did look into this. I got my due process. I got my day in court, and I was exonerated. The university said that the allegations were without merit. No disciplinary action was taken. They paid all my attorney's fees, and they promoted me. And then they pulled all the documents from my personnel file. If that's not exoneration, I don't know what is. The problem is that in this whole kind of Weinstein witch hunt era, everybody's like going back and trying to dig things up to, you know, keep the momentum alive.
So Representative Matt Manweller, you just heard, said that Central Washington exonerated him. Is that true?
Well, the university says they did ultimately promote him. Part of sort of at the second investigation is they denied his effort to have a promotion to full professor. They later that year apparently did promote him to full professor, and the university says they gave him back pay at that point. I asked the university sort of like, are you standing by these reports? And they say the reports speak for themselves, that they're confident in the quality and the thoroughness of the investigations. And, you know, and those investigations said there was evidence to suggest there had been a violation of their policies.
Well, it doesn't exactly sound like an exoneration to back up an outside investigation that said there was evidence to suggest that there was a violation. I suppose that we're getting into one's definition of exoneration.
Right. And the university says they think this report speak for themselves.
Okay. Did the university tell you why they paid his attorney's fees, promoted him, paid him, give him back pay, pulled the documents from his personnel file?
I mean, I that's not entirely clear to me still, but I think there was an ongoing sort of discussion and his challenging some of the decisions they had made. That was sort of the agreement they came to in the end, or determination they came to in the end.
And what does Representative Matt Manweller say to you, the Seattle Times reporter, about these allegations? And there are more.
Right. He says they're not true. I mean, he says that he's never propositioned a student, that he points that there's never been a formal complaint filed against him. He certainly talked a little bit about the potential political motivations. He sort of felt like some of this stuff was really starting to come out in 2012 when he first ran for state office, so that he feels like this, you know, there's some political aspects to it. So that's sort of his part of his response.
Well, Mike, how do you decide whether and when to publish anonymous accusations from people who have not filed a formal complaint?
Right. So in this case, I mean, it was anonymous to us in these records. So these two investigations, they're redacting names of students and former students, so we can't tell who these people are. But to the investigators, these are people they know. They're interviewing them in person. So at that point, you're certainly trusting the investigators to piece together the interviews in an accurate way and represent what the allegations were in an accurate way, vetting that this was a student, in fact, a student of his, that sort of thing. So, you know, this is documented investigation conducted by an outside investigator. Even though we don't know who the women are, they certainly feel comfortable sort of telling their stories through what that investigator.
We're talking about Matt Manweller, the Central Washington University political science professor. What about Matt Manweller, the Republican state representative, ranking member on the state's Labor and Workplace Standards Committee? He's got a big say in dealing with the issue of sexual assault. And what do we know about his time in the legislature?
Yeah, I mean, he's been a really big conservative voice there. He's someone who sort of came in as someone who's one of those sort of family values Republicans, as opposed to gay marriage, opposed to transgender bathroom bill. I think he's been on shows here talking about that, and so there's he's been a very strong conservative voice. He's sort of risen in the ranks as someone who's he's got a strong voice and an intelligent guy, so he's sort of become a part of their leadership at this point.
And what's his record in the legislature regarding sexual harassment?
Yeah, I mean, so on sexual harassment, I think that's sort of a conversation that's just getting started down there. You know, we pointed out in this story that he is a voice on harassment and assault and those issues when they come up. There was a bill this past year on whether, you know, people who are victims of sexual assault can get permanent protection orders against the people they've say have assaulted them, and he was a no vote on that as someone who opposed that bill, the option of getting permanent protective orders. You know, at this point on the whole culture of Olympia, that's just a conversation that's getting started. It feels like there's really sort of a movement down there to figure out how to make it a space for women that they're not being victimized and they can raise their concerns in a manner that'll be appropriately dealt with.
Well, you also published not formal complaints, again, not named complaints, but discussion of Manweller's personal behavior toward women in Olympia. What did you write?
Right. So the women we spoke to down there sort of said, he has a reputation, and he's someone who he's not the only one. He's among those who that women in Olympia sort of talk about as steering clear from. You know, not taking meetings alone with him, just being cautious around him. That's sort of a discussion that's happening among women there. And then there were a couple women who described sort of remarks that he had made to them. That's sort of an ongoing discussion there too.
And what does Manweller say in his defense there?
You know, he said to me that, you know, he's not going to deny making compliments to women down there. He does not know what the whole circumstance of why people wouldn't be, or why there was a discussion about maybe not meeting with him or being cautious around him. You know, he doesn't really see what that's all about. But he's certainly someone who, as with his time at Central, says he's there. He's professional. He's appropriate. He's not harassing people. Is certainly his position.
And you said that he's not the only one that has a reputation, again, deserved or not, that there are some women who say, don't be alone with that person, don't go in an elevator with that person. If he's not the only one, are there others that you are naming besides Republican Matt Manweller, or any of them Democrats? Who else is there?
I would say there's a whole fairly large group of folks that we're still investigating. You know, where it's Republicans and Democrats. There's people sort of all over politics here and in Olympia and across the state. We're interested in hearing stories from anyone who has encountered had bad experiences with those folks to see who we should be writing about, who has had who are folks out there who have been accused of sexual assault or harassment. You know, doesn't matter what party they're in. If we can build a story that we think is strong enough, we'll write about it.
Will we be hearing more names of Washington state legislators in the Seattle Times?
I mean, I guess I, if we were done with the story, it would already be out. I don't know at this point, but it's certainly something I don't expect to be done with right now. It's something we're going to be continuing to work on for weeks to come.
Okay, finally, as far as repercussions, what comes next? Matt Manweller says that this Weinstein witch hunt type of overreach is going to result in male colleagues taking fewer meetings with women or not having closed door meetings. What about the issue of what the legislature could do to minimize or prevent harassment, to protect accusers? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big conversation right now. There was a letter down there among women in the legislature and sort of in the Capitol Olympia area who I think more than 200 now have signed the letter saying essentially that there's a problem here and we need to deal with it. Those are ongoing conversations. I think it's still pretty early to say. I've heard a whole range of proposals to deal with the issue, to make it a better culture down there. Just as one example, there was a proposal to sort of create a more official HR department in the Capitol that doesn't really exist now. That's more handled by clerks' offices that deal with it. So that's one proposal on the table. It sounds like there's going to be meetings and conversations happening going into the session that starts in January and beyond that for sure.
We've been talking with Mike Baker, investigative reporter of the Seattle Times, right on the table today, complaints about a state representative, Republican Matt Manweller, but also talking about how the story isn't over. And Mike is taking your stories, and KUOW has been asking for your stories, record@kuow.org. And we'll watch this together. Mike, thanks for coming in and talking with us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we are going to come right back talking about whether John Hockenberry and Charlie Rose and Al Franken deserve their fates and how the workplace can be a better place. Stay tuned. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and we are going to continue talking now about men in politics and media, the impact their behavior has on women and their careers, women leading businesses, how we can make all of this better. With me in the studio are journalist and filmmaker Grace Kong and Jonathan Sposato, founder of Seattle tech news site GeekWire, startup investor. Together, they're collaborators on Better Together, 8 ways working with women leads to extraordinary products and profits. Grace and Jonathan, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. Yeah.
I want to start with a story that you shared with us, Jonathan. You were booked to appear on the Charlie Rose show last month in New York City before the allegations that got Rose fired from CBS. What happened?
Yeah, what happened was I was all set to go on a show and happy to talk about my book. And then, of course, it was discovered that Charlie Rose was a sexual harasser. And so his show basically imploded. But I decided that because these really good people who work on a show were now basically out of jobs, I decided to continue flying to New York to see if I could kind of, you know, wrestle victory from the jaws of defeat. And I made the folks a proposal. I said, why don't we reconstitute the show and have it be an example of Better Together and pair a really great male and female host, two male and female hosts together, so we can continue the prestige and maybe a bridge between the West Coast and the East Coast, maybe do something with GeekWire that could be interesting, a partnership. And I was ready to do that. And so I decided to sit down with the help of some others, Grace included here, to meet with Mr. John Hockenberry so that we could preserve some continuity, and because Hockenberry was himself would co-host a show when Charlie was gone. And then the idea was to pair John Hockenberry with a number of really amazing female hosts that we could do. I found Hockenberry lovely, brilliant, incredibly funny. I was inspired and energized. I'm like, wow, we can really do this. And after some meetings with PBS National, I really thought it was going to be a go. As you all know, the next day, it was like the next day.
It
was Saturday morning. It's in 2 days later. Then it was discovered that he himself was guilty of sexual harassment. And so it was very disheartening. So I tell this story because I'm actually positing that things like this, bad behavior, stymies value creation. as an entrepreneur, as a business person, I'm trying to actually move the needle forward to save something that was really good, to maybe reboot it and have it be amazing. But we were stymied.
Stymied. And you were at that lunch meeting, as Jonathan said, Grace, not just a business meeting. John Hockenberry is a friend of yours.
He is. He's a very good friend.
Did you have any idea that he had behaved this way, inappropriately touching female producers and interns, bullying his team members, supposedly driving three co-hosts off the show? Did you have any idea he would be the next to fall?
No, and I think the thing to remember here, what's instructive, and you know, I kind of balk from all the villainization that's been going on. You know, I think I had no idea, and he is still to me one of the most thoughtful, talented journalists. It doesn't take away from his accomplishments. People in their private sphere do lots of things, and there are, and I've been in broadcast for a super long time, and men behave badly all the time, I think, in every sector of work and business. And so.
But when you say private sphere, I think of that as something that doesn't involve colleagues and subordinates and people whose, you know, careers could depend
on. Right.
What
and
do you mean?
And the things he's been accused of are absolutely horrific, right? But I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, so now what do we do, right? I mean, I want to move the conversation and the football for women down the field. I think it's enough. I think we get it now. There are lots of men are behaving badly, but instead of punishing them retroactively, what are we going to do about it now? For example, with Al Franken, I'm from Minnesota. I don't think he should resign. I think we also have to have a yardstick by which we measure all of these behaviors, right? I think what Al Franken did is absolutely should be called out, and he's taken responsibility for it. But this is a guy, here's a senator, a leader, one of the very few leaders in the Senate who has done consistently good things for women, supported women, employed women. So isn't he better for the cause of women as a whole by staying in politics in a position of power and working on behalf of women as a repentant sexual harasser, driving him out?
Why not replace Al Franken with someone who's working on behalf of women and men who hasn't sexually harassed women?
But who hasn't? Who hasn't had a moment of bad behavior in the workplace for men? Seriously. I mean, you know, he was taken, that photograph was taken, and these are all private moments from years and years ago. I think, you know, and he was a comedian, right? So I think we cannot keep throwing everybody in the same bucket. What Harvey Weinstein did, what Justin Caldebeck did at Binary Capital, men who had were in clear positions of power over women and stymied their careers, assaulted them, and acted criminally. Those are very different from taking a photograph where you are holding your hands up next to a sleeping woman's breast.
Well, as you know, there were multiple claims of butt grabbing, et cetera. But are you saying the fact that he's a comedian means maybe he was kidding, or that less important? What do you mean by?
No, I guess what I'm saying is, I'm getting back to the point of, I think we have to have a yardstick by which we measure all these things. We have a president who has really sexually assaulted women in terms of violating them and violating their personal space over time and time again. So what standard are we going to be using?
Yeah, and I actually want to jump in here that I actually think that Grace and I have agreement on this very issue, which is something that I talk about in my book, Better
Yes,
Together.
You do.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of the Uber CEO.
Yeah,
but
that's exactly right. And there's and I'm going to bookmark that for a second. The thing that I specifically want to talk about is great entrepreneur, Sheryl Yeoh down in Silicon Valley, who actually created the different levels of sexual harassment so that it's, number one, with the goal that it's clearly defined so that people who are victims of sexual harassment don't wonder, like, oh, wait a minute, was he just kind of flirting cloddishly, or was that actually sexual harassment? And what
so
can
you would
I do about it?
You would define behavior that everyone agrees to?
That's exactly right. And make
this,
it an industry.
This is inappropriate.
That's right.
But wouldn't that have to include compliments and any reference to someone's body or clothes? Or, right, you're talking about things that don't exist now that would be spelled out?
It does. That's exactly right. And it's so that it is incredibly clear. And there are four levels of it. And I discuss it in my book. But I think the meta point, and I'm happy to follow up with you on that one, the meta point is that I do think that right now there's an interesting thing going on. The Me Too campaign was incredibly powerful and just so moving. And I was actually very moved by it when the scale of it started to occur and all these, you know, and a few men came out, a lot of women. But something that worries me is something that Grace touched on, which is that we can sometimes paint in too broad of a stroke here, and that we lump in one kind of offender with another kind of much more severe and extreme offender. And so to me, there's Harvey Weinstein, and then there are some others who are not, whether it's scale or the severity of the offense, it is different. And I do think it's important for us to acknowledge, again, the I'm a geek, the geeky, dorky way of looking at it is, let's have, these things, clearly defined, and there are four different levels or whatever.
Well, I've met
to set an industry standard. But I think broadly, I think we need to acknowledge that there are different kinds and forms of it. So.
Okay. And the bigger point, I think, which Jonathan writes so eloquently in the book is, I think the takeaway from this is we have to say no to high performance trumping bad behavior, because ultimately, long term, these high performers, like at Uber, keeping that engineer or keeping, Harvey Weinstein's secret because he's such a great this, and or Louis C.K. he's so talented X, Y, and Z. Ultimately, they're going to damage the brand, right? Ultimately, they're going to look at all the people at the Charlie Rose Show who are without jobs, right? There are real economic consequences to allowing a high performance to continue with their bad behavior.
Yeah. Well, I've heard people say that the idea is not to vilify or villainize. You don't have to hate or, I'm trying to think of the language, crucify any offender, but that let's just get rid of minor offenders and severe offenders both. We wish you best. I hope you learn something. But yes, Grace, I can tell you want to speak.
Part of the problem with that is then if we just get rid of them all, are we learning anything? I mean, that's my kind of, isn't it better, as I said before, to have a repentant sexual harasser who has always done right by women in politics in a position of power to now, with a renewed, scrutiny, continue as a senator? That's the question I ask. The other thing is, there are larger issues than sexual harassment that have grave, real economic consequences for women. And that has to do with the kind of bullying and the stuff that it's not about personal behavior, somebody grabbing your butt or anything, but it has more long-term systemic impact on lack of promotion for women, lack of equal pay. Jonathan knows.
Yeah, so the Kapoor Center has got some just amazingly powerful research on this that just came out within the last year, and which is that the loss to American businesses, just in North America, and to U.S. businesses every year is $16 billion attributed to women leaving their jobs as a result of sexual harassment, sexual discrimination, and also just unfair practice or feeling that things are unfair and stacked against them. So an example of that could be that a woman has an idea, posits it in a meeting, it gets ignored. A male colleague 5 minutes later says the same thing, and everybody's like, wow, great idea, cool, thanks, Bob. So those kinds of perceptions of unfairness, all of that, sexual discrimination, etc., $16 billion a year. That's a fully burdened cost when you take into account, lost salaries, retraining costs on a part of the company to fill that position.
What's the best way to minimize that? That dismissal, that refusal to use everyone's ideas.
Yeah, I think number one, it begins with awareness, and as I discuss in the book, that number one, men have to acknowledge that they must change, and in acknowledging that there is a problem, that it isn't, we don't live in a meritocracy, and if you don't see women at your company, it's because they're not worthy, or there's a pipeline problem, there's just not enough women graduating from colleges or with STEM degrees. That's all BS, right? So acknowledging the problem is number one. Number two is actually listening harder to, well, one is looking harder for women, and there are ways to remove unconscious bias in your recruiting and your pipeline and how you're mentoring women so that more women come into the system and that more women are advanced in their leadership positions. And I talk about that, ways that you can do that in your book.
Can I relate a story that related in the book? I am clueless about so many things, including business, including tech. You told the story of a company you invested in that was founded by two women. Other investors had said no to them. Here were some of the reasons. Number one, we're not interested in fashion. If I were investing, I'd want to focus on stuff I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. Number two, they said, you don't have a chief technical officer. Mm-hmm. It sounded legitimate. I don't know. Number three, you don't have much experience. Maybe they didn't have much experience. Number four, this product is for women. I'll talk to my wife about it. And my wife also knows more about fashion than I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could take any of these things, and I don't know this field at all, but I could think, Well, I see how that happens,
yeah,
whether they
right.
made a terrible investment decision or not.
Yeah.
What do you do about those kinds of concerns?
Right. That's exactly right, Bill. And I'm glad that you brought that up because in isolation, each one of those questions is, I can understand that. But in aggregate, what you have is this culture of where women are treated as less than, and they're sort of the out group. And so then the connective tissue between the entrepreneur, in this case, two women, and the investor community is that much less. And so I think another way to kind of state this point is that two men walking into the same room with that same concept or a similar concept, and maybe neither one of them are the technical founder. Maybe they're both product manager types, or one person's in marketing, but two men walking into that situation, very likely not going to get those same questions. So I do think that men and women get treated very, very differently at the point of pitching concepts. And there's research that I cite from Harvard that speaks to that.
Grace, you're a woman in broadcast. You've been at the national level. You've worked with these guys we discussed, Charlie Rose, Bill O'Reilly, Matt Lauer. How do you think your career would have been different if Jonathan had written this book decades ago and we all took his advice about more women leaders? How would this change?
Well, I think the Charlie Rose thing wouldn't have happened, right? I mean, here's a big problem. When you take a look at media companies as a whole, and I was an entrepreneur. I started a production company years ago after 9/11 when I couldn't do the, fighting over anchor thing when I had an 8-month-old son and cover 9/11 effectively. I think.
Couldn't your husband have taken over the 8-month-old son?
Right. No, that's women always have to share. The women assume the lion's share.
And that also needs to change, by the way. And it's something. Yeah, sorry. To
right. But in terms of broadcasting, they wouldn't have, if there were women in the room, Charlie Rose wouldn't have gotten, I think, the anchor job at CBS This Morning 5 years ago, because there isn't a single woman in broadcasting who's been around him who didn't know about his behavior. And I think this goes to Jonathan's point in the book, which is the biggest problem we have is when you take a look at all of the people who are metering the oxygen, who are making the big decisions, from board directors to CEOs to mid-level managers, they're all men. They're all men. And that's why you have a blind spot for these behaviors.
By the way, I don't know whether you've been one of the people telling a Charlie Rose story. Is there a Do you mind me asking? Should I not? You say I keep hearing about it. Everyone's got a Charlie Rose story. You've known him. Charlie Rose story?
Let me just say, I don't think there's a single woman broadcasting of a certain age who doesn't have a Charlie Rose story.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like Bill O'Reilly. I mean, everybody knew about Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah. Well, what does it feel like you, having lived through this stuff, it's spilling into the open. I saw on our Facebook page, Yvette put it like this. This sudden willingness to believe women, which has in turn emboldened us to share our stories, has been like suddenly finding myself at a massive rally / group therapy session / rave. It's exhilarating but emotionally exhausting.
I hope that people will look to the book. Everybody says, oh, we can't find enough women for our board. We can't find enough qualified women. I think that's balderdash. I think what's great about this book is it actually gives every manager, CEO, employee the research to go and say, look what Salesforce did. They took a look at their equal women and men doing the same job. They found that women were being paid $3 million less, and on their own, nobody pressuring them, they did their own analysis, and they paid those women the delta, the $3 million. Every company, every employee should insist that practice happen.
Yeah, and here's actually how it impacts the bottom line, right? So the one of the main points of the book is how you unlock a tremendous amount of value in business if you commit to having more women be present. So, for example, if you two companies, right? One all male board versus another company that has three or more women on your board of directors. The second company with women on the board of directors, at least three. Just having them present, right, means that company is going to return shareholder equity 46% higher return on equity than the company with no women on the board of directors.
So,
and there are many more stats like that in the book.
When you say you invest, Jonathan, only, and you're quite an investor, first person to sell two companies to Google, I think.
Yes.
Et cetera.
More lucky than good.
Yeah. So when you say that you will only invest in a company at least co-founded by a woman, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Does that have to do with maximizing profits and or is that a matter of social good?
It's both of those. I believe that you can do well and do good at the same time. I what motivated me to say it, the sort of the emotional half of me, was to catalyze the social good, just to get people to pay attention. Why is this guy saying that? There's got to be a reason why this, you know, person feels this way. But as it turns out, I also believe with my rational mind that I'm actually going to get a higher return on investment. I mean, there's a great study where they studied 80 female CEOs across a 12-year period, and these are like big publicly traded companies, against their male peers. And those 80 female CEOs actually outperformed return on equity by 226%. That was a Quantopian study. So those are the things that I pay attention to. And I firmly believe that women make amazing leaders and CEOs and co-founders and entrepreneurs.
When you worked at Microsoft and you talk in the book about how effective it was to be loud and assertive with Bill Gates, and then you describe women beginning to leave, was there anything about what sounds like, and posters of large-breasted video game characters, and I mean, you describe many of these.
In some groups.
Was there anything about that aggressiveness? Was there anything male about it? And if there was that in any way a key to Microsoft's success? Or should those things be separated completely?
Well, first of all, it's a compound question there. So to the first question, absolutely, it was a lot of what was defined as successful behavior and getting ahead behavior, I would describe as being traditionally masculine things, or sort of conventionally speaking, masculine attributes of being loud and aggressive and take charge and assertive and all of that stuff. And so that's I think where people can feel it very acutely. Women felt it very acutely that, hey, if I'm more nurturing, collaborative, congenial, mentoring, that those things are a little bit more devalued in an environment like that. As to whether that was behind Microsoft's success, it's hard to unpack. I think Microsoft was successful because we were incredibly smart. We had wonderful products. There was great marketing strategy, and we had a great leaders. And I would harbor the hypothesis that we could have done it a little bit differently. That the style and environment could have been a little bit different, and we would have probably had perhaps even more success.
Grace, I was listening to KUOW this morning, and a guest on The Takeaway said, gender alone will not create equality. Agreed?
Agreed. And we also should talk about, I think what the greatest thing about this Me Too moment is that we are learning. I mean, there are all kinds of voices that aren't being heard. And so I think this is a huge opportunity for everybody, for all the great men out there, too, to step up in lockstep with women to help change the playing field. I think once we're kind of done with this wave of outing everybody, I'm hoping that I believe there are many, many good men out there who in ways big and small support women. And maybe now they'll feel more empowered and more emboldened when they witness bad behavior, when they see somebody not getting a proper promotion, when they are asked to have a woman not take credit for her, to take credit for somebody else's, a junior woman's work, that they will do the little things that it takes to move the needle and to move the ball down the field for women.
There are many, many good men out there, and yet we can't find a Senator Al Franken replacement who's going to do just as well without the
It takes time,
grabbing.
You know. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Washington. I worked for the McNeil Air NewsHour for many years, and I see how long it takes to get things done because of the way the legislative branch is structured. It's taken him this far to get to this place, and you know, with all the backdoor dealing and whatnot, and it's just to me a huge loss, because he has legislatively had an absolutely pristine record when it comes to women. And I'm a woman who's worked for social justice and human trafficking, anti-human trafficking, for many, many years. So I don't say this, I don't take this stance lightly. This is a thoughtful, evolved opinion that I've, it's very hard to replace a guy like Senator Al Franken for women.
Could it be that Al Franken, and I'm not saying they're all the same, Charlie Rose, John Huckabee, there's so many names and there's a wide range of allegations here, but could it be that they're going to be okay and hopefully they're going to learn a lesson? Sometimes you learn a lesson the hard way, and
I think they're all good. Look, these guys are all going to be okay. Yeah. I think the bigger takeaway is hooray for middle-aged women, right? Christiane Amanpour is now taking Charlie's place. hello, middle-aged women have been missing from broadcasting and entertainment. Robin Penn Wright is now going to take Kevin Spacey's job as a lead. I mean, you know, these are all good things. The men are going to be okay, but let's just hope that women are better off after all of this is done.
Let's hope. That's Grace Kong, journalist and filmmaker, founder of Santoki Productions. Jonathan Sposato, founder of Seattle's tech news site GeekWire. And
co-founder.
Co-founder, yeah. Sorry. And an angel investor. You're angelic. And an author of Better Together, 8 Ways Working with Women Leads to Extraordinary Products and Profits. I want to thank both of you for coming and talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Bill. Appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to The Record. We're going to be right back. Changing gears here. You are probably creating a lot of trash / recycling this holiday season. We're going to help you do your best. Welcome back to The Record on Twitter at KUOW. The holiday season is here, a time of gathering with loved ones, honoring traditions, throwing away stuff like crazy. Americans generate 25% more garbage between Thanksgiving and New Year's than the rest of the year. So let's figure out how you can not toss so much holiday garbage into the landfill. And our chief tactician, welcome back, Kevin Kelly, general manager of the Recology Cleanscapes Recycling Facility in Georgetown. Good to see you again.
You too. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you reminding me as soon as you walked in that based on our last conversation, we got into recycling sins. This is the $20 I owe you. Here you go.
Thank you so much.
Sure, sure.
It's nice to finally get this from you.
Well, just help me not go further into debt with you, okay?
Let's do it.
You dinged me fairly every time we discovered another Radke faux pas. So let's save us all. Kevin, what does your facility look like on December 26th?
It looks like Christmas. Uh-huh. That's when we start seeing all the wrapping paper that has...
Christmas is your Christmas.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. We see a big increase in the amount of paper and materials that start coming through, the boxes, all of those Amazon boxes that have been delivered to people's houses. Mm-hmm. It starts looking like Christmas at our facility the day after Christmas.
Speaking of which, you told me last time you were here that you can recycle an Amazon box even with all that tape on it. That was one thing where I actually didn't owe you money, because that was a great feeling. Okay, so you get a ton of paper, you get bows and ribbons.
You know, we do get bows and ribbons, but we don't want them.
You don't want them, yeah.
They do not belong in the recycling bin because these will tie up our equipment and cause problems for us. So we want to stress to the folks out there that bows and ribbons are not recyclable, and they should be reused, frankly.
Reused. You're not telling us to have a bleak, bowless, ribbonless Christmas.
No, I don't. I'm not the Grinch here today. Okay. I want to encourage people to, you know, still enjoy their holiday season and decorate things and do those things. But you can reuse these items. You can come up with creative solutions to wrap your gifts, for example.
A creative solution?
So one of the favorite ideas I like to see is people use old maps. So, you know, these days your
maps.
Yeah, your map is in your phone generally if you have a smartphone. And so if you have an old Thomas guide or something, or just maps laying around the house.
Sure.
Use those.
I probably have an old road atlas in the trunk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wrap your gifts up with it. I like to use, my young daughters produce a lot of artwork, we're not going to save that forever, but it might make for some nice wrapping paper.
How do they feel if they see their artwork as wrapping paper that someone's gleefully tearing open?
Well, the grandparents love it.
The grandparents, yeah. So they never have kids now.
That's right.
Have to see it. So, you know, by the way, it reminds me, we may want to encourage a culture of opening carefully and not tearing things open, because we're going to reuse that Christmas.
And that's the other thing. If you feel like maybe these ideas aren't for you and want to just use the traditional wrapping paper, you are welcome to, and you should, frankly. But you can reuse it. You use it one time a year. And if you fold it up, put it away in a box, or one of the things I like to do is I'm a terrible wrapper. And so I will just put things in a bag.
Yeah.
Cover it up with a tissue paper.
And feel good about it.
And feel good about it. You can reuse that over and over again.
Nice. We also could just give each other less stuff.
You could. And one of the things to consider in all of this is that rather than giving material gifts, you can give experiences. I know the mountains are getting hit with snow right now. The skiing is probably great. You can give somebody a couple lift tickets if somebody likes a concert or even a nice meal somewhere. Giving somebody the gift of an experience actually can be more enjoyable than something that maybe will be enjoyed occasionally and then forgotten about, end up in the garage, and then headed off to the dump at some point later.
One more Christmas note. I can't imagine in Seattle anyway, we have people putting the Christmas tree in the dump, right? We all know to compost that sucker.
I hope so. One of the things we really want to encourage people to do is to set their tree curbside into 4-foot sections, removed of all the decorations and the tinsel and whatever else may appear on it. Mm-hmm. And that will be composted, turned into a nice soil amendment, and see another life that way. So we really want to encourage folks to do that when they're done with their tree.
Okay. If you get a real tree, get real and compost the
Absolutely
thing.
Right.
Kevin Kelly, General Manager, Recology Cleanscapes. It's a recycling facility in Georgetown. We're talking about how to reduce the amount of garbage you generate over the holidays. But it bears repeating that we are losing some control over what gets recycled and what doesn't. Last time you were on the show, Kevin, you said some of our recycling goes overseas, especially to China, but China is changing what it will take from us. When is China going to start rejecting some of our recycling?
Well, so what China is doing now is they've undertaken an initiative that they call the National Sort. And this is geared at making sure that contaminated material or garbage doesn't end up in their country. And so their desire in this is to make sure that they're not the dumping ground for the world's waste. And what we say is, everything that is listed on your brochure, everything that your city, your county, or your solid waste hauler, recycling hauler tells you can be recycled, can be. The issue comes where folks who maybe they want to feel better about how they discard something, and so they put it in their blue bin. It's not actually recyclable.
Yeah.
We see things.
You didn't do a good thing just because you put it in the blue bin.
That's right. But people tend to think that they do.
Yes.
And so we really want to encourage folks to make sure that they understand what is recyclable, because what China is doing is they are saying we are restricting the amount of those contaminants that can enter the country. And so effective January 1, they're really clamping down on what we call mixed paper, which is just general paper, and low-value plastic. So these are your buttercups and things like that, typically things that store food. So they want to clean up the act, and that's not a bad idea. What we need to do is communicate with people so that they understand what is truly recyclable and they're handling the materials in the appropriate way.
Okay, and we talked about some of that. Last time you were here, we're talking about some now. You probably have a handy link for us to tweet out, I would think.
We do. So there are two great resources here locally. Both Seattle Public Utilities and King County have references where you can ask specifically for each type of material, and they will tell you where it goes.
Okay. I imagine as manager of a recycling facility that you are completely above reproach. When it comes to recycling. True? You're perfect.
No. Even I make mistakes.
Huh.
Everybody does. I think sometimes, too, you can have material that's attached to other material that ends up in the bin. One of the things that I have, and it's actually not for the blue bin, but it's food waste. And this is a big deal around the holidays as well. We as a region have done a much better job of diverting food waste from landfills and into compost sites. But we just because we're composting it doesn't mean that we're sort of wasting that resource. It takes a lot of energy to bring food to grow, to bring it to market, mm-hmm. all of these things. So even if you're, taking your dinner and you're putting it in the compost bin, those are still resources that we've not used the way they were intended.
Right. The priority is reduce, reuse, recycle.
That's right.
Okay.
That's
You're right. Doing a better thing by the reducing. Speaking of food waste, a listener, Jim, sent us a Shel Silverstein poem. You got your headphones on. I want to play just a little glimmer. This is about a person who is terrible about garbage. Here's a bit.
Coffee grounds, potato peelings, brown bananas, rotten peas, chunks of sour cottage cheese. It filled the can, it covered the floor, it cracked the window, it blocked the door with bacon rinds and chicken bones, drippy ends of ice cream cones.
Okay, I was writing fast there, but Jim's friend, the guy who emailed us, said, my friend points out we could compost all this stuff now. Chicken bones I caught on the list. Should what was the girl's name? Sarah, Cynthia, Sylvia Stout. Should she be composting those chicken bones?
So we have come a long way from this great Shel Silverstein poem.
Were you familiar, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? It's big among the whole, in the garbage community, everybody knows Sarah, Cynthia, Sylvia Stout.
We walk around reciting it.
Sure. Oh,
yeah. Now, these days, everything that was just listed there in that segment can be composted.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, including the chicken bones.
She won't take the garbage out. She's probably not going to go out to the recycling bin either, or the composting bin either. I mean, she needs a change of heart in general. But bacon rinds, cottage cheese, banana peels I caught, coffee grounds. Yeah, but chicken bones too.
Chicken
bones are compostable. Okay, Sylvia. Go and sin no more. So what about other food-related waste? A producer of ours is a bubble tea drinker, and she feels guilty about the straws. And the thing is, you kind of have to have the straw to have the bubble tea experience. What would you tell her?
Well, I've never had bubble tea myself, but...
Really? Delicious and wasteful.
I know, but I...
You know what I'm talking about? You have to have the straw with the pointy end to jam through the cellophane. By the way, you've got cellophane, which isn't typical, on your drink, and you need the big... It's a big fat straw to suck up the tapioca balls or whatever. That's what the boba, the bubble. Yeah.
So there are different straws that you can buy. You can buy a metal straw, for instance. You don't have to use a plastic straw.
Carry around your metal straw in case you swerve into a boba tea joint.
Absolutely. So let me give you kind of a scope of the issue with straws. It's estimated that Americans use about 500 straws per day, and they discard them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes they end up in a landfill, sometimes they don't. And oftentimes, little bits of plastic end up in the ocean. So there's actually been a campaign going on here in Seattle, led by the Lonely Whale Foundation, to encourage people to, as they say, stop sucking.
Stop sucking. I've heard of that.
Yeah, to stop using straws. Because I think in that instance, with that drink, you might want your straw, you might need one. But how many times have you been to a restaurant where they deliver you a glass of water with a straw in it?
For no reason.
You don't need
There's no
straw.
Boba in the bottom of that thing.
That's right.
Am I sucking up the ice cubes?
No.
Okay, what about, do they have really good paper straws that will punch through the cellophane and be good for boba tea?
Not that I'm aware of.
Rats.
Yeah.
Okay, what about, you mentioned messy garbage, like foil wrappers on a burrito. Should I, I'm going to clean that thing off. Should I just chuck it?
Yeah, so if it's contaminated with food, that is a contamination that we will worry about and that the Chinese will worry about when we send that material over there. In fact, there's a few specific things like food waste, like medical waste, so, like a blue latex glove. Mm. Those types of things, they will be specifically looking out for. So, what we say when it comes to recyclables in general is we want the materials to be empty, to be clean, and to be dry.
Okay, can I pass on another Facebook note from Joshua? Disposable diapers. What would you say?
Diapers belong in the landfill.
Okay, Joshua, landfill the diapers. Tiffany says medical waste. You said no way.
No way on the medical waste. Okay. That should be handled, in fact, separately from normal waste.
Linda writes, what about cling film? I guess that's like saran wrap.
So saran wrap, as long as it's clean and handled appropriately. So I don't know if you remember last time I was here, I talked about bagging the bags.
Oh, I remember.
So okay.
Yeah, yeah, I'm bagging bags.
So that's great. So if you take this cellophane and you...
I don't like
you. No. And that's one of those things
just
where
telling you.
If you think differently about the type of things that you buy, that's probably a packaging or something that you could do without. And so if you think differently about, okay, what am I purchasing and how can I reduce, going back to that hierarchy there.
Okay. The year is almost out, so that's our time this time. We're going to come up with something else because I just like how much you know, and you didn't take my money this time. Kevin Kelly, General Manager of Recology Cleanscapes, a recycling facility in Georgetown. Thanks for helping us reduce the holiday waste.
Thanks so much, Bill. Appreciate
it. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Thank you for listening. Hope we didn't waste your time. I think not. Our show is put together by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening today. Listen tomorrow, too.